The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Say goodbye to thieves. Say hello to CUDA-CAM by Barracuda Networks, the leader in cloud security and storage solutions. CUDA-CAM is a complete cloud-hosted video surveillance solution that captures high-quality footage when motion is detected. Just plug in one or more CUDA-CAM cameras with no network or camera configuration. Video evidence is automatically encrypted and stored in the Barracuda Cloud for secure access from any web browser or mobile device. Visit CUDA-CAM.com to learn why CUDA-CAM is so easy on your wallet, yet so hard to avoid.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a 100-day milestone for the Trump administration nears.
How Congress stands in the president's way.
Unions at odds over their support for President Trump. What's at stake for one union leader?
If we propose legislation for national right to work, that would be a red line.
And concerns about more cases of Zika in the U.S. as the weather warms.
I think the risk of this actually is quite high.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Next weekend will mark the first 100 days for the Trump administration, and on Friday, the White House celebrated something to include in the president's accomplishments. White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy is with us. Stephen, he helped orchestrate the release of an American from an Egyptian prison.
Aya Hejazi, a 30-year-old aid worker from Northern Virginia who was imprisoned in Egypt for the last 3 years, was here at the White House on Friday. The president said that he is very happy that he was able to facilitate her release.
Stephen, something the president isn't celebrating, what he's been able to get done in Congress. What does that look like going forward?
No significant legislative achievement to date. The president did an interview with the Associated Press on Friday in which he said that there would be the proposal of a massive tax cut coming, a bigger tax cut than ever, he believes. And he says he may lay it out on Wednesday or shortly thereafter. That's just before the 100-day mark of this presidency. But in the midst of his unveiling of a tax reform package, we also have the possibility of a government shutdown here in Washington of the president's 100th day in office.
As Congress looks at negotiating the budget and also, what, take two of health care reform?
Through this weekend, House Republicans are going to be huddling telephonically before they come back to Washington at the end of their two-week spring break to discuss whether to move forward with a revision to their Obamacare repeal bill. Whether it has enough support to pass the House still remains to be seen. But the president is hopeful that it'll all happen over the course of the next week, that they'll avoid a government shutdown, that he'll be able to unveil this massive tax cut proposal, and that the House will finally pass an Obamacare repeal bill.
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thanks, Stephen.
You bet, Steve.
We're learning more about the gunman who killed a police officer and wounded two others in Paris Thursday. A handwritten note was found by the gunman's body defending ISIS. More from correspondent Elizabeth Palmer in Paris.
Cell phone video of the shooting, still not officially confirmed, appears to show the suspect's car next to a police van and two men, weapons drawn. In another video, you can see what looks like the gunman's body lying in the road. He's been named by French media as Karim Cherfi, 39 years old. Authorities haven't confirmed that, but police have searched and sealed Cherfi's family home east of Paris. As security forces rush to secure the area and clear shocked bystanders away to safety,
you have to stay back, please.
Details of Cherfi's criminal record emerged. Le Parisien newspaper said he'd done jail time for, among other things, shooting a police officer more than a decade ago. This attack couldn't come at a more sensitive time. Voting in France's presidential election starts in less than 24 hours, and the country is on edge after multiple terrorist attacks since the mass shootings in 2015.
Two Tennessee parents are spending their first weekend together with their daughter in weeks. After police say she was kidnapped by her science teacher, police found the two in California.
After traveling some 2,500 miles over the course of 38 days, teenage student Elizabeth Thomas is safe, and her science teacher, Tad Cummins, is under arrest.
She will soon be on her way back home. Tad is in custody of law enforcement, facing a set of charges that could keep him behind bars for many years.
The two had been the subject of a nationwide search since March 13th, when they disappeared from Culioca, Tennessee. 2 days later, they were seen in Walmart surveillance video some 600 miles away in Oklahoma City. Police declined to answer questions about whether Thomas left with Cummins willingly.
She's a young girl that's with a grown man. He needs to be held accountable for kidnapping this girl.
After traveling from Culioca to Oklahoma City, they drove more than 1,800 miles to Cecilville, California. On Wednesday, a man in the area recognized Cummins' vehicle from an Amber Alert and notified local authorities. The couple was tracked to this small cabin after this man called 911.
Someone showed me a picture and I was like, that's the guy.
Sheriff's deputies arrived at the cabin Wednesday night, but they waited until 9:30 Thursday morning for Cummins to exit. He was arrested without incident. They found two loaded handguns inside the building.
Carter Evans reporting Cummins could face 10 years in prison. The family of former New England Patriots player Aaron Hernandez says they plan to donate his brain to researchers who will test for CTE, a neurological disease linked to concussions. Hernandez killed himself in prison where he was serving a life sentence for killing a friend days after being acquitted in a 2012 double homicide case. Correspondent Tony DeCopo reports an investigation into his death is underway.
Massachusetts State Police and the Department of Corrections are still investigating Hernandez's death in a single-occupant cell. Investigators believe one of the last people to see the 27-year-old alive is a close friend who is now himself in an isolated cell on suicide watch.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he's focused on rooting out and prosecuting leaks within the government as the Trump administration tries to track down who was behind one of the biggest leaks in CIA history. Here's correspondent Jeff Pagase.
Whenever a case can be made, we will seek to put some people in jail.
Federal prosecutors are assessing whether to file charges related to the release of stolen U.S. information by the anti-secrecy organization WikiLeaks.
We are going to step up our effort and already are stepping up our efforts on all leaks.
Led by Julian Assange, WikiLeaks has published classified information, including nearly 750,000 sensitive documents from Chelsea Manning. In September of 2011, Assange shared his mission with 60 Minutes.
If you're a whistleblower and you have material that is important, we will accept it, we will defend you, and we will publish it.
Last year, the organization came under fire for publishing thousands of emails from the campaign of Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton.
WikiLeaks! I love WikiLeaks!
The Justice Department inquiry comes as the CIA and the FBI are looking for an insider, either a CIA employee or contractor, who exposed top-secret government documents and hacking tools. Sources familiar with the investigation say it was someone who had physical access to the material. From his Ecuadorian embassy's safe house in London, Assange said the 8,000 stolen CIA documents were being passed around before WikiLeaks published the trove last month. CIA Director Mike Pompeo says Assange is a national security threat.
As long as they make a splash, they care nothing about the lives they put at risk or the damage they cause.
But it is still relatively early in this process, and several officials tell CBS News that charges against any one person or WikiLeaks itself have not yet been finalized.
Still to come on the weekend roundup, unions and the Trump administration.
There's a balancing act that has to go on here.
That's next on the weekend roundup. On the CBS News weekend roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. President Trump on Tuesday tried to spur more companies to buy American and hire American, signing an executive order that directs the government to review its visa program for highly skilled foreign workers and ensure that government purchasing programs buy American-made goods as required by law.
We are sending a powerful signal to the world. We're going to defend our workers, protect our jobs, and finally, put America first.
The move's part of President Trump's efforts to fulfill some of the economic promises he made back on the campaign trail, and it's gotten the support of some labor unions who want to put more of their members to work. It's why we're talking with Sean McGarvey in the Washington Bureau this weekend. He's head of the North America Building Trades Union. Sean, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me what your relationship is like with President Trump.
Well, we come from the construction industry, so we have a pretty long history with President Trump, particularly in New York, also in Atlantic City, and some other places in the country where we've worked with him over the decades.
Your union originally endorsed Hillary Clinton for president, right?
That's correct.
So she obviously lost.
Right.
How much time did it take to warm up to President Trump?
You know, once the election's over, and the leader of the free world's elected, and we move on. We're all Americans, and we get behind and support our president.
Some of your members, though, are opposed to President Trump and many of his policies. Some even booed President Trump at a recent speech that he was invited by your union to attend, right?
We're not a monolith, of course. And there wasn't really much booing. I don't know if you were there. We had a handful of people that stood up with some signs and a couple hecklers. But compared to 3,000 people in the room, not many.
Why does he resonate as a Republican with union members, especially in the trades and the building industry, as opposed to Democrats?
Well, I think we're probably decades into a long, sometimes seemingly painful separation from the Democratic Party, as it's kind of looked to focus on other things than, you know, what it historically brought the working class together with, which was economic populism and jobs.
Why would a Republican who supports right-to-work measures, built his hotel in Washington with non-union contractors, and who the IBEW, one of your unions that you represent, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, says more than 60% of his projects developed outside New York City and Atlantic City include non-union contractors. Why would you support that?
Well, I think you probably have to look at why. The question is why. If you're talking about projects in Washington, D.C., his hotel, did we have enough signatory bidders that were competitive to bid the project? I know the answer to that question. No, we didn't. We would have the market density here. So it's not always a fact that they wanted to build their hotel non-union. Much of the work on that hotel was union. But in some of the work that was non-union, in some cases, we didn't even have a union contractor bid it.
But it's not just his use of unions in building hotels, right? He spoke into South Carolina, for instance, where he supports their measures to strengthen their right-to-work laws. Some conservatives whom he supports want to make it easier to prevent unions from gaining a foothold in their state. How do you support policies like that?
Well, we don't support policies like that. And President Trump said a lot of things in a lot of places to a lot of different people. And we'll go by what he does and not by what he says, just like with any other politician.
What's your red line?
What's my red line? My red line would be if the president promoted the disillusionment of the Davis-Bacon Act, federal prevailing wage. That would be a red line. If we proposed legislation for national right to work, that would be a red line. But, you know, you talk about Donald Trump. We have lots of problems with politicians in the other party, okay, who attack our jobs, okay, when it comes to energy projects. 50% of the membership of our unions work at some time during the year in the energy industry. Well, the leaders of some leaders in the Democratic Party that we could never support because of their positions on energy, which would put our people out of work. So, you know, there's a balancing act that has to go on here. And at the end of the day, when it comes to infrastructure investment and energy policy, President Trump happens to be, you know, very strong on those two things. And those are two of our main three buckets that we care about,
which are jobs and primarily construction jobs.
Correct.
I want to go back to an interview you did about a year ago where you were asked about his infrastructure plan and at least the wall. And you're asked, do you think that's a serious proposal? And you said, no, I don't think anybody does. What's changed since then?
Well, I think that now that he's gotten into office and the team that he's assembled to work on infrastructure, I think he recognizes that after campaigning for 18 months around this country, knowing the construction industry the way he does and knowing the ability to move people into the job market, into middle-class jobs in the construction industry, that that's a really good investment for the country. So I think he's really serious about it. I'm really impressed with the team he's put in charge of doing it.
Do you still think this multi-billion dollar southern border wall is a reality?
I don't think so.
Why?
I just don't think it makes sense. I don't think they have the money to put towards it, and it won't get the effect that at the end of the day that they want.
You mentioned just a few minutes ago the National Right to Work Act. That's already in Congress. Mm-hmm. President Trump hasn't weighed in on it yet. If he does support it, how will you react?
We'll react badly, but I don't expect him to support it. That piece of legislation is introduced in every Congress. This is nothing new.
This is a Congress, though, that's controlled by Republicans and a Republican in the White House.
Well, if you know, if you're obviously the Washington Bureau here, you understand that there's different caucuses within the caucus. okay? And in the building trades, we happen to have 55 reliable friends on the Republican side that support us and our issues. So we would expect that they will not support the Congress or any piece of legislation that goes against the economic interest of their supporters. And one thing that the president campaigned on was raising people's economic opportunity, raising wages. You don't raise people's wages by promoting right to work.
How do you want to persuade, or how can you persuade President Trump to support measures that increase union organizing? Do you care about that?
Of course I care about it, but I'm a firm believer that in order to organize, if you've done a little bit of organizing, you have to understand that the people you're organizing have to want to organize. That's where it starts. Because if you have a good, solid base of a group of people, okay, who are a majority, who want to organize themselves for the purposes of collective bargaining, they will do it no matter what's thrown in their way. It happens every day in this country. The problem sometimes is I think we attempt to organize people who don't necessarily want to be organized. And that's where some of the failure comes in. So as long as people want to be organized, they have the opportunities to do it right now, no matter who's in power, what the current law says, how the National Labor Relations Act, they can do it.
Sean McGarvey, he is head of the North America Building Trades Union. Sean, thanks for coming in and talking to us in the Washington Bureau.
Great. Thanks so much.
Up next, concerns about more Zika infections this summer in the U.S.
I think the risk of this actually is quite high.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Check out CBS Radio News podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Scott Pelley every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our Week in Review magazine show. It's all available from CBSRadioNews.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey.
Okay, ready?
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, officials in Key West unleashed a new weapon they hope will combat the spread of Zika. 20,000 lab-bred male mosquitoes infected with a naturally occurring bacteria. They opened cardboard tubes that look like paper towel rolls holding them. The mosquitoes will mate with wild females whose eggs won't hatch. Scientists hope it reduces the population of the mosquito that carries the Zika virus amid concerns about more infections in the U.S. as the weather warms. Let's talk now about bugs and Zika with the bug guy, Mike Raup. He's a University of Maryland professor of entomology. Mike, you've brought a few friends with you here.
Yes, Steve, I have. I've got some of the notorious London underground mosquitoes, Culex pipiens molestus. These are the guys that are breeding somewhere in the steam tunnels or subways of New York City. On the Upper West Side, they bubble up into the apartments over the wintertime and they bite people. How crazy is that?
All right, so it's getting warmer outside, obviously. It's also getting buggier.
Yes, it is.
What are we seeing?
Well, we're beginning to see some insect activity. We know that mosquitoes with this warming world are beginning their activity earlier in the year. This is going to spell some trouble down the road, I think, Steve.
What kinds of mosquitoes should we worry most about?
Well, the ones we're really worried about are these guys like the Culex mosquitoes. These are important vectors. They transmit the West Nile virus. But here in the Washington, D.C. region, as we move further south along the Gulf states, Florida and Texas, places like this, what we really have to be concerned with is that yellow fever mosquito, Aedes aegypti, because that's the one that's the vector of the Zika virus.
What's the chances of that mosquito coming back and exposing millions of people again to the risk of Zika?
Well, this mosquito has been resident in the United States for more than a century. It goes all the way from the Gulf as far north as Philadelphia, perhaps even a little further north. So it's here, and that one's here to stay. We're not getting rid of the yellow fever mosquito. As the summer moves on, and particularly in this warming world, Steve, where things start earlier and these mosquitoes can simply complete more generations a year because their development is directly linked to temperature, I think the probability is rather good that we're going to see additional cases of local transmission of Zika virus in places like Florida, again in Texas, and across the Gulf. probably by midsummer. So I think the risk of this actually is quite high.
So this is something we can't forget about. I mean, we didn't really worry about it over winter.
No, absolutely not. It did drop off. The last local transmission cases, I think they ended sometime in December. But the problem now is you have a steady influx of people traveling from Zika-infested countries. They are bringing the virus back with them. You now have the local populations of the yellow fever mosquitoes, and it just becomes a probability game in terms of generating enough mosquitoes, enough biting of humans before you get that local transmission.
You mentioned yellow fever. How much of a concern is that now? Because we've been seeing some yellow fever pop up in places like Brazil, where Zika was really at the epicenter of that.
Well, historically, we've had yellow fever outbreaks as far north as New York City and Philadelphia back during the First Continental Congress, which was in Philly. Hey, those guys had to get out of town because there were 5,000 deaths due to yellow fever. We have seen these outbreaks periodically, even here in the Northeast. But fortunately, right now, yellow fever, that particular virus, is not endemic in our populations. Those yellow fever mosquito populations are lower here in the Northeast, number one, due to better mosquito control practices and the fact that we're more aware of these things, we're doing a better job. So I think the risk here of yellow fever is actually quite low, and hopefully the same in Florida.
So nothing like we see in sub-Saharan Africa when it comes to yellow fever.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed that that baby doesn't get started here in the U.S. We have enough problems right now with West Nile virus and this new Zika virus, chikungunya virus. We got a whole...
Dengue even?
Dengue is a possibility, but again, this is primarily right now a Southern America, Central, and Caribbean disease. We don't worry about dengue and local transmission yet here in the U.S.
Okay, you've also got some invasive bugs, right?
Absolutely.
And things like stink bugs. You got some right here.
Yeah, I got some of the brown marmorated stink bugs. These guys came into Allentown, Pennsylvania back probably in sometime prior to the 1980s. They have since spread out. They are moving west. They're moving south. They're from border to border, coast to coast now. Kind of the bad news here with these guys, it has to get pretty cold in our wintertime to knock these guys back. So again, with climate change, when we're not getting down to single digits or below, these guys are going to do just fine. That's the real problem.
How much trouble are invasive bugs like stink bugs causing the U.S.?
They are huge. Right behind, I think, things like habitat destruction, habitat degradation due to pollutants or over-harvesting of forest materials, basically the elimination of habitat for our native species. I personally think invasive species are probably number three on this list. Global change certainly is right up there on top of this. But see, these things are working in concert now. Some of these global change factors, like a warming world, it allows invasive species from the south to reach higher altitudes and higher latitudes. They're simply moving further north.
Mike Raup, he's a professor of entomology at the University of Maryland. You can follow his updates on bugoftheweek.com. Thanks, Mike.
My pleasure, Steve. Good luck. It's a jungle out there.
In more ways than one.
Yes, it is.
Now to fighting depression with an unusual medicine. More from correspondent Weijia Jiang.
Army veteran Vivian Cook has long struggled with debilitating depression. She has tried alternative therapies and medication to cope with her symptoms.
It wasn't effective. Some of the side effects would be headaches or stomach aches.
Then 3 years ago, she tried something different after hearing about a study testing Botox to treat depression.
We don't believe it has anything to do with looks.
Dr. Eric Finzi says facial expressions are part of the circuit of the brain related to mood.
Fear, anger, and sadness all go through this muscle. Very important. So Botox basically inhibits the muscle and just calms it down. So it becomes more difficult to feel those negative emotions.
The makers of Botox just announced the final phase of testing for depression will begin. Dr. Finzi says previous studies show between 50 to 60% of patients benefit from the treatment. Vivian says she noticed a change in her depression almost immediately.
My mood was better on a day-to-day basis.
And even though the study Vivian took place in is over, she says she will continue to get the injections.
Weijia Jiang reporting. Coming up on the Weekend Roundup.
It's great to meet you.
How a robot is helping kids with autism. Please follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS Radio News. And I am at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. One robot is helping kids with autism. Correspondent Don Champion explains how it works.
It's great to meet you.
Meet Milo the robot. He's got moves and skills.
I can shake my head no.
Shake my head no.
But he's not a toy. He's a new tool teaching children with autism how to work through social situations in the classroom.
Can it wave?
They learn these sets of social skills and are then able to actually start interacting with other people.
Richard Margolin and his company Robokind spent 3 years developing Milo. He can smile or frown while interacting with students.
We can count with them.
And help them with calm down tactics like counting to 10.
9, 10.
Margolin says Milo's consistent speech patterns and behavior repetitions are key for children with autism.
He stopped and took a break.
When you bring technology into it, it's something they can engage with. It's something that's less overwhelming to them.
Teach you calm down.
Keenan is a first grader at Kip Truth Academy in Dallas. His teachers say working with Milo has helped him at times like this, when he answers a question wrong.
I try my best.
He's using his words. He's able to isolate, you know, what it is that he's feeling or thinking.
Right now, Milo is being used in 285 schools nationwide. The creators hope to expand to 2,000 schools by the end of the year.
I love you, Milo.
Lessons learned here with Milo can be put to good use with their friends and family in real life.
You're right.
Good job.
Don Champion, CBS News, Dallas.
You remember dictionaries, right? When was the last time you actually cracked one open? Well, Merriam-Webster has been turning to the web as it explores how people communicate and holds them accountable. Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large, Peter Sekulowski, spoke about it with Charlie Rose and the CBS This Morning gang.
Online, how much online traffic do you get? And is that where people are now going to their dictionary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the dictionary is still in print. It's also an app, a very popular app, and it's online. So there's three different ways to look up a word, and I use probably all three every day. A lot of people do. And by the way, print is alive and well. It's still profitable. It's just a smaller part of our business.
Yeah, 100 million page views per month.
Yeah.
But you've also used Twitter in a way to engage people in the discussion
sure.
about what words really mean.
Absolutely. And I think we're having a national conversation about language right now, and the dictionary plays a part in that conversation. People turn to us very naturally when a public figure uses language in a remarkable way. So, for example, with volunteer, that was a statement from United that we could report upon. We're reporting the data from that 100 million page views a month. We could see that the word volunteer had spiked to the top, and so that we know what the people are curious about. And here's the thing: I mean, why is it now that just copying and pasting the definition of a word like feminism, like uh-huh. fact, like complicit.
Uh-huh.
Why is that viewed as a subversive act? That's the bigger question.
Well, when Kellyanne Conway said that she didn't identify as a feminist because right. it's associated with, in her words, as being anti-male and prohibition, Merriam-Webster pointed to the definition of feminism and said this, the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities. So what's the goal?
Well, that's the definition. So the fact is, that was a great example of an instance where a public figure raised the question of meaning. You know,
yeah.
The president said military, he didn't mean military. He said wiretapping, he didn't mean wiretapping.
But you didn't have to point that out.
No, but we did. But we did see in the data that people were checking.
I see.
People were checking. They looked up feminism. And in that case, as with, for example, complicit, the question of meaning was raised.
Mm-hmm.
And so where do you go? The dictionary has a kind of unique authority to call balls and strikes on spelling and meaning.
Because Gail had asked Ivanka Trump about
That's
being
right.
complicit.
That's
which
right.
was that Saturday Night Live skit.
Yeah, so it spiked twice, once after the sketch mm-hmm. and once after your interview.
You also introduced new words online. This year you did throw shade. I love that phrase. First world problem. How do you describe what you're going to put in? Well, how do you describe your new words?
The new words that are added, we just added 1,000 new words about a month ago. That's an old story. I mean, that's still the same slow process of lexicography. The job of a dictionary maker is revision. You know, we have to make sure that the changing language is reflected in the pages.
Give us an example of it. Go ahead.
Of the dictionary. So there are three criteria. We have widespread use of a word so that a lot of people use it in different publications. Long-term use, mm-hmm. and that is that there's evidence of the word being used in a consistent, sustained way. And finally, meaningful use, that most of the people who use the word kind of mean the same thing when they use it. And that's when we can write
it. So what's an example of a new word that's been added?
Well, we just added a whole bunch. But, I mean, net neutrality, for example. Those are two words. When we have compounds like that that are not self-explanatory, we have to add them as a single entry. Binge watch, another example. Yeah. Photobomb, you know, this kind of thing.
The Smithsonian National Zoo is trying to give cheetahs a fighting chance at a long future amid dwindling numbers in the wild. Correspondent Chip Reed paid a visit to some of its newest cubs.
These tiny cubs are just 3 weeks old and steadily gaining weight. They're brothers and sisters born to 7-year-old cheetah, Mitty.
They sound like they're purring. Is that purring?
No, they're actually growling.
Scrubs are required to reduce exposure to disease and the human scent around the cheetah den, which would upset Mitty. Adrian Crozier, a biologist with the Smithsonian, is the manager of its cheetah reproductive and research program. She checks in on the young cubs and weighs them about twice a week.
Does this ever get old?
No, it's always fun to have cubs.
The scientists here hope for at least one cheetah litter a year, and this year they got two. 12 cubs total. While two babies did not survive, having this many cubs born so close together is a virtual population explosion.
Every day that they make it through, that we just have a better chance of them surviving to adulthood.
Cheetahs are listed as vulnerable, and some scientists have been calling for the fast cat to be moved to the endangered species list.
Why are they vulnerable?
Mostly loss of habitat. The areas that they occupy in Africa have been reduced dramatically.
Cheetahs have disappeared from an estimated 76% of their natural range. Today, they are mostly found in southern Africa, especially Namibia. But here in the Virginia mountains, Crozier and her team are doing critical work to help the species survive.
I hear you've been called the cheetah cupid. You're a matchmaker.
Yes, we try to make as many good cheetah matches as we can every year.
Scientists refer to the walkway between the adult cheetah enclosures as Lover's Lane.
Often this is where we will let the males meet the females for the first time on the fence.
So far, the Institute has bred 46 cheetahs in Virginia, and Crozier is hopeful their work will prevent the world's fastest land animal from disappearing forever.
Just us having these two litters in the last few weeks just gives us huge hope. Very optimistic about the populations that we manage under our care and linking more with the populations in the wild.
So the cheetah's here to stay.
The cheetah's here to stay.
Coming up, Prince Harry opening up about the death of his mother.
It was 20 years of not thinking about it and then 2 years of total chaos.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS Radio News, the original radio news network, is now on Amazon Alexa. Amazon Alexa. Whether you have the Amazon Echo, Amazon Tap, or Echo Dot, you can listen to our newscasts just by setting CBS Radio News to your flash briefing.
Here's your flash briefing.
Or just ask for CBS News and hear our 24/7 stream through our partners at TuneIn.
This is CBS Radio News on TuneIn.
Wherever you want to listen, CBS Radio News is there.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. New concerns about diet soda following a study on its possible links to dementia. More from CBS News medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook.
About one out of every five Americans consume diet drinks. That's more than 3 billion gallons a year.
I prefer diet because I just think it tastes better.
The researchers analyzed 10 years of data where people gave detailed information about their eating and drinking habits. Over that decade, 5% developed dementia. Drinking at least one artificially sweetened beverage a day more than doubled the risk of dementia. But researchers found that other causes, such as hypertension, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, or high cholesterol, might be to blame. Matthew Pazze is an investigator with the Framingham Heart Study.
This can be confusing to people. Can you help make this more clear to people?
Sure. It might be that those who consume diet sodas may have an increased risk of getting diabetes or becoming overweight, and this might be associated with an increased risk of dementia.
What are you telling your friends who are asking you for advice?
Well, since diet soda and regular soda have no real nutritional benefits, I suggest that people avoid them and drink water instead.
New questions from federal prosecutors about settlements Fox News paid out as the network copes with the ouster of its biggest star over sexual harassment accusations. More from correspondent Anna Werner.
The board of 21st Century Fox met inside Fox News headquarters.
Shame on Fox!
While outside, the National Organization for Women declared the ouster of host Bill O'Reilly isn't enough.
We thought it was really important to come out and shame the 13 members of the board of directors of 21st Century Fox who've allowed this culture to flourish.
Federal prosecutors have questions, too. A lawyer representing former Fox News co-host Andrea Tentaros, who's suing former Fox News chairman Roger Ailes, says the U.S. attorney has subpoenaed one of his other clients.
I want to be clear that I don't know what the nature of the investigation is.
But attorney Judd Burstein told us the subpoena suggests the investigation by the Securities Fraud Division relates to the method in which settlements were paid.
I do know that when Fox News sought to settle with Andrea Tentaros, they wanted to pay the settlement out as salary. The inference I draw from that is that there may have been a studied effort to hide the fact that there were all these settlements being paid out by disguising them as salary.
Tucker Carlson will replace O'Reilly, but of the 50 or so companies that yanked ads from the show, most told us today they have not decided whether to move their ads back to the time slot. Viewership has remained steady. Public relations specialist Howard Bragman.
Viewers are not their problems. Advertisers, yes. They have to go and look at their advertisers, the people that pay for their network, where the profits come from, and say, here's the changes we've made, and here's why we're a safe place for you to put your money.
Fox News did not respond to our questions about the U.S. attorney's investigation. O'Reilly called the allegations against him unfounded, and Roger Ailes has denied the allegations against him in the past.
The manhunt for the so-called Facebook killer came to an end Tuesday when police say the suspect took his own life after a short chase by police near Erie, Pennsylvania.
Cleveland Police Chief Calvin Williams says Steve Stevens was spotted in a fast food parking lot by a passerby who called the Pennsylvania State Police.
The vehicle fled from that area. There was a short pursuit in which the vehicle was stopped. As the officers approached that vehicle, Steve Stevens took his own life.
Stevens shot and killed Robert Godwin Sr. on Sunday and posted the video on Facebook, something Williams calls a lesson to be learned.
This is something that should not have been shared around the world. Period.
Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Former President George H.W. Bush sent back to the hospital Wednesday.
The 92-year-old former president was readmitted to the hospital for a recurrence of the pneumonia that he battled for 2 weeks in January. This time it's described as a mild case, and a spokesman says Mr. Bush is in good spirits and well on his way to recovery.
Correspondent Pam Coulter, Prince Harry's opening up about coping with his mother's death as he works to promote efforts to fight the stigma of mental illness. Here's CBS News correspondent Charlie Daggett in London.
Prince Harry was just 12 years old when his mother, Princess Diana, died in a car crash in Paris. He told Britain's Telegraph newspaper he dealt with the agony by not dealing with it at all.
It was 20 years of not thinking about it and then 2 years of total chaos.
Now 32, he said he came close to a complete breakdown, at times on the verge of punching someone. Finally, his brother, Prince William, convinced him to seek help.
I can safely say that losing my mom at the age of 12 and therefore shutting down all of my emotions for the last 20 years has had a quite serious effect on not only my personal life, but also my work as well.
The candid interview coincides with the 20th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana. This new memorial garden marks that anniversary outside Kensington Palace. It's where Diana lived, now home to her two sons. Like Diana, Harry isn't afraid to reveal his own vulnerabilities in order to help others, says royal correspondent Roy Anika.
I think by doing that, by finally saying, yes,
I have had issues with my mental health. I have finally sought help for it. And it's fine. It's okay to not be normal all the time. I think Harry will have done wonders to destigmatize what is still a taboo issue in this country.
And he's hoping others will follow his lead.
Some of the best, well, the easiest people to speak to is a shrink, or whoever, I don't know, the Americans call them shrinks.
Yeah.
Someone you've never met before, you sit down on the sofa and say, listen, I don't actually need your advice. Can you just listen?
Just listen to me.
And you just let it all rip.
And he lets it rip in the ring, too. He's now taken up boxing, saying it helped save him. Charlie Daggett, CBS News, London.
Now to another prince and the dispute over the music he left behind.
It was for sale online for a while and shot to number one on iTunes.
This is not religion.
But a federal judge in Minneapolis said no, in effect, blocking one-time Prince sound engineer George Boxall from releasing six of Prince's unpublished songs, citing a confidentiality agreement that he had while working with the superstar years ago. The title track from the Deliverance EP album was put on sale online, then removed a few hours later. Boxall now has orders to deliver the recordings to the Prince estate. A hearing will be scheduled on making the injunction permanent. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
The heavyweight in the world of audio is accused of listening in on its customers.
A new Chicago lawsuit accuses the high-end headphone maker Bose of listening in on customers. The suit claims the company's app for wireless headphones tracks preferences and sells that information to others. CNET's Dan Ackerman.
It does indeed say it can collect a lot of information, including GPS information, Bluetooth information, maybe information that comes from other apps on your phone.
The suit's been filed by an individual who seeks $5 million in damages and the end of the practice. Bose has not commented on it. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
We appreciate you listening to the Weekend Roundup. We want to get your feedback. Send us your love letters, recipes, DIY tips, whatever, to weekendroundup at cbsnews.com. You can do an online search to find past episodes. Search for CBS News Weekend Roundup. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Dory Valerio helps out in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.